And thank you for picking it out, Julie. I mentioned, welcome everybody, February 11th, Owen Rennick's paper on irreducible subjectivity of the analyst. I mentioned earlier before everyone got here that Alexia had to be away. So. Owen Rennick is a San Francisco training analyst, and as you may have gleaned from the paper, a brilliant thinker and capable of very much thinking outside the box. I bring him up in this course mainly for that reason, that his papers, I could have picked three or four others. His papers always make us think about the psychoanalytic propositions that we take for granted. And so that's the reason I'm putting him forward is among a handful of American thinkers who you would associate with cutting-edge work. So let's begin in our usual monotonous way in terms of the format and style of the paper. You know, my analytic teacher who used to direct the Yale Child Study Center and was a training analyst and known for being a bit of a sadist, would always call on the student who had his head in the book. You know? So even if I hadn't read, I learned just to look him straight in the eye. He never called on me.
I found it quite conceptually dense.
Yeah.
So I found it well written, but sometimes, I mean, he's cramming a lot in, and it's quite broad scope what he's talking about, and so I think in that way it was quite tightly written, but it could be a little disorientating to me. If I stopped to think about it, anyway. You could go with it and flow with it and take his argument, or you could stop and think, and then it got confusing.
Well, maybe we can look at some of the places it got confusing.
I find him quite explicit, actually. Even though, I mean, I agree with you that it was dense, but nevertheless, he was quite, you didn't have to read between the lines, I thought. And I felt he was quite differentiated and nuanced in his perspective, and he sort of surprising perspective.
I felt he didn't want you to read between the lines. That's why he skipped on and was quite closed in some of his statements. And so you kind of swallow them, and then it was when I stopped to think, I thought, hang on a minute, that's a really closed statement about something that is very ambiguous, maybe.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But he voices his opinion in a way that you can disagree. Be it more on the positive.
I found myself the whole time while I was reading it trying to think about the previous paper by Mitchell, because there is a lot of similarity in their perspective, and trying to recall a lot of what's in this paper. I find them hard to differentiate since we read them both recently. So for me, maybe I need to work a little bit, or hopefully this will help to kind of outline the specifics, I think, of this argument. Because, I mean, the whole aim is talking about the analyst perspective and interactional involvement. So...
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Ogden as well.
Right, yeah. Very much. Mm-hmm.
I thought the maybe I'm getting at the same thing Lars and Joe are, rather than putting it dense, I found it extremely tightly argued, scarcely a wasted sentence to move the argument forward. And if you could not skim this paper. I mean, you could skim it, but each little piece of the argument, you needed each little piece of the argument to move to the next piece, to the next piece, to the next piece. Okay. And maybe as we go through it, we can. So you, as you might expect from my having just said that, I would like to go through this paper bit by bit, so that we see how he puts his argument together, and so that your arguments and disagreements and thoughts about it can come up as we move through it bit by bit.
Can I just add, he's not a great poet, though. That just came to my mind reading this analogy of the skier and surfer, and this psychedelic practice is not unlike good sex. That was, you know, other writers would have thought, I guess, of better metaphors or analogies.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe it just was...
I thought you were trying to be cool.
Yeah, I know, but...
Being sex, yeah. I'm modern.
Well, maybe that.
That's great. Well, and also a little bit radical, right?
Yeah.
To compare, you know, to compare psychoanalysis to good sex, and also to throw in that
that's the kind of level of self-disclosure they're talking about, huh?
To throw in that little piece about, well, we'll come to it, but about a corrective emotional experience, you know, the two things that will get classical analysts trembling will be to compare what they do to sex and to mention the CEE phrase. So that those, I thought that was an effort to do just that, to give it a kind of radical kick. But also, I actually thought, I mean, of course it depends on your point of view, but he does have a kind of cool persona, you know, as a human being. But I thought it had to do with how much of his work is centered in his body, the skiing part, you know. In one of his papers, he... I don't think it's cited. No. In one of his papers, he He gives an example of a clinical vignette from an analysis with a woman patient in which he posits a homoerotic transference to him, and he includes in his evidence for that, much as he did in muted form here, his experience during an analytic hour of coming to imagine that he had a woman's genitals that were progressively becoming swollen, aroused, and wet during the session. And, you know, so here's a man who is comfortable in his body, let's say, and so to, you know, having read that and others of his papers, that he would compare it to skiing, you know, something pushing back on him. That seemed to fit, though that's not to take anything away from your suspicions about what else might be going on. So we start in this paper from the proposition that psychoanalytic interaction is interaction between two complete psyches. And he means that that the analyst is not only the observer, right, but also the a participant in the experience. And he talks about the way in which the patient is expected to come in and say the most intimate things about wishes, fears, concerns, and in listening to that, the analyst's being aware of his own personal motivations and what's being stirred up by what the patient is saying is thought to be extremely useful. And the way it is thought to be useful is if you can get a hold of a fantasy or a current of strong feeling that's being stirred up in you before you put that into action, you know, before you get aroused, would really be the ideal. Before you make an interpretation to the patient that hasn't been filtered through your awareness of the emotional reaction stirred in you, such that the words you choose to make the interpretation or the tone that you use to make the interpretation belies that you are having a strong emotional reaction to what, you know, that you're irritated or annoyed or feeling insulted or, you know, whatever it might be. The idea is, to the extent that you can catch that early, then the prevailing analytic wisdom is that counter transference feeling, thought, fantasy won't be put into action and won't then become a hindrance to the work. And really where this paper begins is Rennick telling us that failure is inevitable, that there will always be lapses in our capacity to do this, and that we rationalize this fact by by consoling ourselves that, well, we can learn from that and understand something about the patterns transpiring between analyst and patient. And certainly that's true. But the principle of technique is, two things. Countertransference, awareness takes the place of countertransference enactment, and ideally awareness before and instead of action.
That's a classical idea.
Right.
Okay.
Toby, did
yeah, I was just going to ask the same question because I got a bit confused. So that is a pre-Rennick sort of conceptualization.
Yeah, I mean, he's laying out the classical theory of technique,
mm-hmm.
Which he's now, which he then will proceed to turn on its head. Because he lures us out, right, into acknowledging that the ideal is we'll catch the countertransference before we enact it, but failure is inevitable. But we still hold that up as an ideal. That's supposedly the ideal technique, so that the idea of the analyst as a complete psyche, as someone who will have thoughts, feelings, reactions to what the patient said, in the ideal, even though that's counted, in the ideal, he says that the analyst has these feelings is acknowledged, but it's regrettably the case, right, is how he puts that. And because the idea there is if you're really quick, you can nip these reactions in the bud and nothing. But what he's saying is if you look at what that's about, what that's saying, it's saying that really we would much prefer to be the objective analyst who doesn't have these feelings. You know, in effect, we catch them so quickly that they will have no influence on what's going on between analyst and patient.
But is that, I mean, surely people would argue with that. I mean,
he does.
Yeah, no, I mean, as in the classical position would say that it's not regrettable, but it's something different, that it's a good thing that you have those reactions. Some of them do leak out, but you utilize them, they're the tools of the trade. And so this idea that we're aspiring after an ideal of objectivity, I don't really see in as being so kind of upheld in the classical model.
Yeah, I mean,
reactions to that?
I think she has a point, because it's been a while now that countertransference has been considered a tool. I mean, analysts don't say that it's something interfering with the analysis anymore, but it serves them to understand certain things about the patient in a better way, maybe. So in that sense, it's not that classical analysts want to become like immune to sensations or feelings, or they would lose a very important tool in their practice.
But then I'm wondering whether that's the, you know, the point of the question, because I think it's more, or maybe it's more how your interpretation would be influenced by that, you know, whether you can make sure that your interpretation is sort of takes place after your countertransference feelings have been digested or not. And I think he argues that this is, you can't avoid it, it always is.
Yeah.
It's always, it always permeates through your interpretation.
But wouldn't you say also that just even the fantasy that analysts can experience these and then catch them and interpret them and not either have them permeate or not have them permeate, that that's all vesting, that that's all contributing to this, the vesting of all of the authority in the analyst, right? The sort of fantasy of omnipotence that he then defends against with humility.
In a way, he's saying, if you act them, you're not able to process them because you're not, you're unable to think if you're acting. This, he mentions at a point the Freudian, I don't know, it's like a
reflex arc.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in a way, he's saying, okay, you feel all this in the conscious transference, but then you need to be very, like, robotic and take all this emotion and hide it so you can, like, give a clean clean interpretation that is not tainted with your emotions. You know, like, you're not able to show the patient that you maybe are angry or irritated or happy or whatever.
But you mean that he's ascribing that view to the classical analyst? That?
No, I think, I think that's what he's saying in the classical technique. It implies that you have to not show.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of keep a straight face in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But only after working, having it worked through, you know, not by dismissing it and just somehow.
No, just like being very, robotic, because it's like it doesn't seem human to be able to deal with your emotions in such a, kind of surgical manner,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you just give this immaculate interpretation.
Yeah, I think that he's basically pointing out that there is this illusion of objectivity in the analyst.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's even in interpreting the countertransference, and I think that's the key point, that he's saying that, yes, he did acknowledge, who was it in 1950? I can't remember, someone famous, a client.
Yeah.
Can't remember her name.
Paula Heyman.
That's right.
Yeah.
That the countertransference needs to be interpreted, but at the same time, you interpret that countertransference and you believe that you're getting it right, but he's arguing, no, you're getting it wrong. Most, in 99% of the case, and then you retrospectively have to look at yourself again and again and see how your interpretation is actually acting out.
Mm.
You're learning from your failures and the responses of the client.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's revolutionary. I do think that it's not been argued before.
I think I've never read a point like the one he's making here, and it makes a lot of sense, actually.
So he brings us to the theoretical problem that he is then going to take up in the rest of the paper, which is, if we admit that the individual psychology of the analyst is at the heart of technique, then how is it that we have not systematically taken that into account in our theory of technique? And so, of course, he's going to. That's, you know, once he gets us to that point, he's going to make that, make us aware of that. He talks about the awareness of countertransference always being retrospective. It's our awareness of it is always preceded by enactment, right? Subtle or not. It's in some form of action. And when we're able to profit from the exploration of our technical errors, it brings that point home, he says, because these errors differ from the rest of what we do only insofar as things have conspired to make us explicitly and more dramatically aware of what's going on in that moment. So he's saying that when we pick up a countertransference enactment, it's really a more dramatic observable experience of what's going on microscopically all the time. And I thought that if we took a closer look at that clinical vignette on 556, it might bring that home. You see there, here is an everyday clinical sequence. You see that? Justin, why don't you read that paragraph?
Here's an everyday clinical sequence. The patient is describing her joyless marriage. As I listen, I am aware of a sense of immobility. I'm sitting absolutely motionless in my chair and my limbs feel heavy. Possible interventions come to mind, but I decide against them, one after the other. I have the feeling each time that I might say, what I might say would not lead to anything useful. I note that the remarks I keep thinking, making all aim at a rather active investigation of my patient's situation. Questions about her attitudes toward her husband and the future of the relationship, how she regards her options. I realize I have an urge to rescue her from her marriage and end her distress. The feeling is a familiar one to me, reminiscent of, among other things, my childhood wish to be my mother's savior.
Sure.
We could summarize this vignette by saying that a piece of self-analysis led me to become aware of an omnipotent rescue fantasy generated by my own psychology, a fantasy that was not appropriate to my actual task as an analyst and my responsibilities toward my patient. The insight I gained was quite useful. Keeping it in mind allowed me to avoid embarking on a mission of my own I might otherwise have pursued at my patient's expense. Thus, in this instance, it was true that self-analysis forestalled analytically unproductive, personally motivated behavior on my part. Awareness of a countertransference urge took the place of enactment of it with beneficial results.
Susie?
However, it was also true that before I came aware of it, that countertransference urge in question had already been determining my activity, my technique, the posture and the physical sensations I observed in myself were manifestations of an inhibition I was employing to guard against anxieties generated by my impulse to rescue my patient. And this driven passivity on my part was exerting a very significant influence on how I was listening to what my patient said, as well as on my interpretive efforts. The possible interventions that were coming to mind, I rejected one after another, not because I had thought through the issue of their analytic utility, but because they carried a forbidden meaning for me. In fact, once I became more fully aware of my state of mind and some of its personal historical determinants, I allowed myself to facilitate more actively my patient's exploration of how she was dealing with her husband. The outcome of this line of investigation was analytically quite fruitful, too. Eventually, as you might expect, we even came to look into my patient's need to elicit rescue by me and her difficulty initiating her own efforts to extricate herself from her marital problems.
Can I just quickly ask a question? Isn't that just precisely what Ogden talks about when he talks about the analytic theory? I mean, this discovery of something that in the analysis that is colored both by the analyst's own experience and the analysand's steering projections.
Thoughts on Lars's idea? People remember the Ogden paper enough to respond? I would say a little different than Ogden. In the sense that if you recall, he wasn't really talking about inhibitions or impulses being stirred up in him. He was really talking about a dimension of thought that was unusual for him. That is, he began to find himself having these peculiar thoughts about the envelope and about the
garage
and, you know, the suffocating fumes and being shut out and all of that. And I would say that had he been able to catch hold of something this proximal, he probably wouldn't have had to, that probably wouldn't have happened. That experience. It seems to me that it was in the both of those patients were patients who were hard to reach, and I don't think that's what he's saying here. I get your drift, and I think it's a good pickup in terms of, you know, the analysts looking at what's going on in his own mind. But I think this patient is much more reachable to the analyst. And in effect, I think what Rennick is saying here is more reachable than my comfort would tolerate. I was really restraining my impulses to, you know, give her a good whack and say, you know, don't let, you know, give marital advice. Don't let him push you around, you know, whatever. He would never have been so crass, but, you know, that he recognized this wish to save her, and even recognized his old, you know, parts of his past that was playing on. That chord in him was being plucked by this patient's experience and interaction with him. And so we can argue about that, but I think that there is a subtle difference that has to do with the reachability of the patient.
But doesn't this vignette also support the counter-argument? Because you know, had this dynamic he's describing, had it not resonated within himself that much, because he had some sort of personal history somehow linked to that or to that experience, wouldn't it then just been a pure sort of projective identification on the side of the patient, and then sort of running counter the his argument that it's always, that the interpretation is always polluted by, you know,
by what?
Polluted by some undigested psychology of the analyst.
Well, it seems to me that you could easily understand this in terms of the patient's projection, that the patient was projecting that active, you know, that active thinking, judging part of her mind into the analyst, and it struck active thinking chords in the analyst, which he was tempted to act on. And then inhibited,
yeah.
And it created enough strain in him. I think that's one of the points I want you to get, is the way in which it created enough strain in the analyst that the only way he noticed it was by noticing his posture and the way he was sitting and how quiet he was in the hour.
But what would have happened if, you know, the same sort of situation had occurred, but without him having a personal experience that he can somehow associate with that. So he would have just experienced the pure of countertransference that she's trying to put him into this position, eliciting this sort of, you know, calling for this sort of reaction in himself.
Well, I mean, I would guess one of two things. Either in the next 10-minute segment of the hour, the patient would have been talking about things that did link up in some way with the analyst with a different set of strings. If these wouldn't have worked, but you know, might have led the analyst to begin thinking about how passive the patient was being, how was that coming about, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
But that's the
or what?
That would be the classical position then in terms of technique. You know, if you don't have to deal with your own sort of internal affairs related to that, that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, I can't, with that example, I can see that in this particular situation, it helped to be aware of the fact that he, you know, he had to struggle or had to work through some things in himself and take that into account when evaluating the countertransference. But I can't really see that it has to be the case all the time. Just by assuming a situation or imagining a situation where this...
Oh, so your thought would be, what if he hadn't been so conflicted about this area, and he could have read this directly and interpreted directly without having to go through his body and all of that. Well, I think his argument would be that would be an example of the same process going on at such a fine grade of magnitude that he wouldn't be aware of it. And he would, it would be more of a thinking process. It would be more of a somewhat cognitive process. But I think he would also argue that the words, for example, the words and the tone that the analyst used to make the interpretation would have been influenced by this micro grade of process going on. Is that, you follow me?
I didn't know if someone else. I think I struggled to explain or express myself because I'm still not satisfied yet. You seem to know.
I'm just wondering also as a follow-up to that, sort of how essential is the physical enactment of it or whatever? He seems to be talking about enactment in a somewhat literal sense of bodily changes or postures or whatever, right?
He means including speech. That speech would be in
behavior.
So something he's done, right?
And you know, later
done
he,
or not done.
And later he says, really the difference breaks down because thought is trial action.
Right, right.
So
right, but it seems like because one of the things that seems sort of pioneering or whatever is his willingness to read his body, right? To focus on not to inhabit his body, but so I was just wondering how important that was then to this theory of enactment and awareness collapsing.
Oh, you mean with Lennox?
Yeah.
I don't know. It sounds like it was important to him, but you know, I think you could have there are analysts who, of course, aren't so centered in their bodies. Mm-hmm. There are analysts whose way of being receptive to what the patient says is to follow the shift in musical melody in their minds, you know. Different keys, different rhythms,
right.
Different paces, you know, Baroque versus modern, you know, right, so on and so forth. So that I would think each analyst would come to this with different receptive capacities. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to lose Toby's.
Can I try it, like, put it differently? Maybe.
Yes.
Can I ask something? Because I think it's relevant. But in my understanding, Rennick argues that there is no such thing as a situation that will not evoke an own counter-transfer, an own relevant situation. That the only way that we understand one another is through our own experiences.
Exactly.
Which is some sort of a priori category, in a way. I struggle to sort of...
What do you mean?
Well, just to state that, I mean, I can see this sort of constructivist position, but yeah, I don't know if it really reflects the reality that you're always reacting with your own sort of internal world to
internal
world to whatever you're listening to in an hour in a way that it would affect your counter-transference.
How would you imagine it otherwise?
I'm just thinking about that.
But it is sort of a, I mean, you're right saying that it's...
I mean, you always do subjectively react, but I'm wondering about this critical point, you know, of how that would affect your counter-transference evaluation. And then... as a consequence,
well,
your interpretation, basically.
He's going to come to that, but maybe Boesky would. Maybe Boesky would come to the rescue here.
I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but it seems to be losing some kind of common sense distinctions between different clinical situations. I don't know if that's what you're. Because if you collapse it all and say it's all filtered through.
If you collapse it all, it's what?
No, it's okay. I've lost it. The thing about he reduces so much, I mean, it's kind of a the problem I have with this is it's kind of a given, okay, everything is going to be, you know, how can, we know no one can be objective, and anyway, that's a different thing, but I think that, okay, I'm going to leave it. It's a different point.
But that's maybe what I meant with this sort of a priori character of this argument.
Yeah. Because it's almost like if you take away this idea that there are cases where you are quite consciously aware of your own experience and that's what you're saying, as opposed to just the usual clinical hour stuff, which you're, of course you're influenced by your own experience, but it's not so at the forefront. You know, you're losing those distinctions that I think were there for quite a common sense practical reason.
Mm. It's almost as if, you know, it's almost as if he's flipping it completely from the analyst as being blank to the analyst being involved all the time, and then there's no gradual difference
yeah.
in how you react and how you make
yeah.
sense and meaning and attribute meaning to this different.
Well, I think he's saying that we have been using these subjectivities to arrive at meaning all along. But we have been hiding behind an illusion that we're actually objective when we do it.
But did people
and treat them as aberrations, somewhat, right, or
mm. boxes? No, I see that, but I still can't make sense of the sort of clinical translation of that. Because I was thinking this vignette, you know, thinking of a maybe contemporary Klein and who would just interpret it as a, you know, put in the transference and the here and now, what would be different then?
I wrote that interpretation. Let's see. Could the way you describe your marriage and the difficulty you have doing anything about it be an invitation to me to come to your rescue?
Yeah.
I mean, that... to me, that seems like there's nothing boldly Kleinian about that.
Mm.
But it's Kleinian in the sense of I wouldn't have been able to do that before working with the Kleinians. Mm-hmm. But it really has to do with focusing on the transference quite closely and its impact on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what gets added by his conceptualization then?
Well, I feel what gets added is that there's a self, potentially, there's a self-deception going on as well in the Kleinian, as in their transference interpretation in many cases might be wrong and they're not prepared to back down from that, and that might be an acting out situation. And I think that's really what he throws in there as added meat, so to speak. I mean, to me.
Because that is still an example of that sort of transference interpreting, and is still an example of this presupposition that it's all from the patient.
But then what? I mean, then what? You know, what do you offer then that is not imposing something from yourself on the patient in an interpretation?
Well, his argument isn't that you don't impose something of yourself.
Right.
His argument is it's inevitable, better to acknowledge it
okay.
and to study its consequences mm-hmm. than to pretend you're not doing that.
Okay.
Because if you then pretend you're not doing that and the patient is reacting to just that,
you miss something.
Then you're going to be way off, right? You're going to be saying, oh, this is new dynamics in the patient, when it's really a reaction to what's just gone on.
It's a metaphor that's with the thermometer. I mean, you have to acknowledge that you are affecting the temperature of the water when you
yeah.
put the thermometer in there.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, no, we're not going to look at this, you just need to measure the what is the change there? Measure.
I thought that would have been done before already.
What?
Like, I thought that was already sort of in practice before. So maybe what he does is to really acknowledge it and write about it.
Yeah, I think so. So when is he writing this paper?
93.
93? Okay, so 15 years old, really. 16?
Yeah.
So the analyst's awareness of personal motivation in the clinical situation has its origins in, Rennick is claiming, has its origins in observing some action manifestation in the analyst that could include a shift in speech, an inhibition, remaining silent. In his vignette, it seems to me significant that, and he doesn't make much of this, but one after the other, I have the feeling each time that I might say just what I might say would not lead to anything useful. So you see, there is a certain kind of futility that he's a subtle sense of futility. See, I would jump on that, saying that that is, you know, that's coming from the interchange between the patient and the analyst. That something has something is making me. If I'm not Eeyore, you know, on a daily basis, right? And so now I'm feeling like, oh no, oh, I could say this, no, that won't work. Oh, I could say that, no, that won't work. I mean, that something is going on between us to make me feel like that. And so, see, I think that fits in a nice way with your idea about projection, see, because I think that part was probably projected too. He talks about it as a kind of inhibition of his own kind of incestuous wishes, really. Right, to save his mother. I'm sure it's saved, but on a white horse with a shining lance, right? That the observation that this behavioral manifestation of this motivation can be of the finest scale of magnitude. I think that's important to keep in mind. I thought that was totally neat, the citation of Darwin and James. And then, you know, if he's going to take on the classical techniques, he's got to take on Freud, and he cites the interpretation of dreams and the reflex arc, you know, which is either motor action or thought, one or the other, mutually exclusive. And he says no, right? And by the way, that is that little passage in Freud is the heir to the technical advice, block the patient's acting out. You know, we try to interfere with the patient's acting out. You know, which, by the way, a few decades ago would have been, you can't get married during analysis, you can't buy a house, you can't make any major decision when you're in analysis. It derives from this little passage and the its implications, that you'll be undermining the analysis because all of those fantasies will be gratified out there, you know, in the real world. So he says, you know, clinical analysts confirm that thought and motor action are not mutually exclusive. Because thought is a form of trial action, that we're actually having just that kind of minuscule microscopic grade that he's talking about when when the patient says something and a fantasy is generated in us. Huh? So if we accept the analyst's activity, how he listens, his technical choices, it's constantly determined by his own individual psychology, in ways that analysts can only become aware of after the fact, then what we're really acknowledging is the necessary subjectivity in even ideal technique. Okay? So, you know, now he's got you by the... right? Toby.
Could you maybe add again the consequence of that?
He's gonna, I think, right? He's gonna tell you the implications of that.
Okay.
So if we don't come on it as we go through it, jump in. But he's gonna tell you this. And then he kind of goes on a detour to show us about the kind of unacknowledged, hidden, quote, objectivity of the analyst. All of that stuff about interpretation, you know, that interpretation is a kind of I know and you don't. You decode the manifest meaning of what the patient is saying and reveal the unconscious meaning, but it's really a matter of I know and you don't. He also alludes to this being, Lacan picked up on this in his idea, I can't do it in French, maybe one of you can, the analyst is supposed to know. Lacan links that with his concept, le nom de père, the name of the father. Lacan makes a pun that plays with that. So Le Nom de Père, the play, is, I don't know if I'll get it, le non dupe air, the one who is not duped. That is, by embracing this illusion that the analyst knows. You see, it's one thing for the patient to attribute to the analyst he's supposed to know, but it's another thing for the analyst to imagine that he knows. duped into being the one who knows, you see, then that goes on all the time, right? That there is no objective analyst, and that the analyst is both being duped and duping himself to believe that he knows all. That's a little Lacanian digression, but in the midst of these digressions of, they're not really digressions, he's grinding away at it's really pointless to ask the analyst to one, that it's impossible for the analyst to be objective, and two, that it's pointless to ask the analyst to set aside personal values, feelings, beliefs, and so on. Really the question isn't whether you set them aside or not, the question is whether you acknowledge them or not, whether you are aware of them or deny them. The unavoidable fact of the analyst's subjectivity is the problem of the observing instrument's effect on what is observed. That is Denise's reminding us about the thermometer and the trying to measure the temperature of the glass of water. You want to explain how he uses that to make his point, make this point?
The measuring tool, which is a thermometer, is inevitably affecting what it wants to measure, what we want to measure, the temperature of the water. So, I mean, if in an analysis what we want to explore is the patient's psyche, the analyst's psyche, his own psyche, is inevitably affecting and influencing.
Excellent. That's extremely well put. Let me back you up one little part. So if the thermometer is always affecting the temperature of the water, what do you do?
You measure the temperature. I don't know the physics of it, but you measure what is the change.
So you acknowledge there will be an effect, and you then find scientific ways and mathematical ways to take it into account, right? So what would the analogy be in analysis?
Just, I mean, what he's doing in the article, I guess, the analyst needs to acknowledge that he's affecting the...
That it's inevitable.
It's inevitable,
right.
And just like, he doesn't really kind of explain that well how in technique his kind of his kind of new theory that his thinking is going to reflect. That's something I think at the end it kind of left me, because he mentions the gratifications of the analyst and how, where is the border of the analyst using.
Yeah, we'd have to read more Rennick to get that. I mean, one of his papers is called Playing Your Cards Face Up. His idea is that if all what he's talking about in this paper is true, then it's also problematic if the analyst appears to hide behind some kind of mirror, you know, that we know we're readable is his point, and the way that influences how he works with patients.
So it would actually look different, his technique slightly. Because remember last week we were saying, well, Mitchell, for all that he seems to be proposing something kind of radical, would actually, his analysis would look almost exactly like...
Well, you know, you might say that, and I think maybe there are certain ways that it would.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't look a lot different in this little vignette, does it?
No.
Mm. Right?
But I'm thinking, I mean, normally...
Huh? What?
Like, normally in analysis, I mean, there are millions of things that have been constructed in order for the analyst to kind of be behind. The analyst and the same down, he's not able to see the analyst's face, and the expressions or whatever is happening. So there's a lot of different, you know, techniques to kind of hide the analyst. So is he saying that this is not the way it should be? I mean, there are lots of things in the article.
No, I don't think he would argue with any of that. I just think he would say, I think his point would be, we're not objective, we're not mirrors. I think that would be his point.
And I would say that there's no point in having, I mean, these, you might have these things as the analyst sitting behind the patient, but they don't protect the analyst from being read. I mean, that's, I think, for me, he advocates openness. To a very large extent, openness to be taking a meta perspective on your own thoughts in the analysis, and in making sure that you really do interpret it, even the unsettling thoughts, which you may think you can hide from the patient, but there is really no point, because if you do that, then you'll really.
And so he's not. He is not saying that. He is not advocating rampant self-disclosure. He is simply saying that if you acknowledge the subjectivity of the analyst is there and is in play, then it's better to acknowledge that and follow its impact, study its impact, which he says is called analyzing the transference. Do you remember that passage? We'll get to that in just a minute, but hold on to that. So, the practical implications. I won't satisfy Toby, but we'll press on. We're on 563, I think. The first is to discard the widely accepted principle of technique, holding that the so-called countertransference enactment is to be avoided. You know, he's now informed us that that's impossible, doesn't exist. That's an illusion, right? Better to, you know, he's not suggesting, I mean, he says that explicitly. This is not saying anything goes. It's saying that something is going all of the time. Better to acknowledge it and follow it in what's transpiring between analysts.
Can I just say something about
please?
Just that with that kind of line of argument, you assume then that you have a transparency to your own, or at least a certain amount of objectivity comes in again, you know, because you're having to acknowledge these things and then acknowledging them and we take note of them and...
You need to be conscious of
them. You need to be on top of that again, and so subjectivity lends itself to another objectivity.
Well, subjectivity... I think he would say that... He certainly acknowledges the problem of, I would put it the other way around. I think he would acknowledge that the how do you know what you know if everything is subjective? I mean, he talks about that when he... what is it? That's part of the article.
Is your argument sort of along the lines of an eternal regress that you say, okay, we can always take a yet another higher level meta perspective on it, so where is the end?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to start sort of acknowledging subjectivity, then subjectivity is all you have, then you're kind of stepping outside of it. And that's, but also, I mean, I just... This might not be completely relevant, but for me, a really big part of, well, big thing this made me think of was the idea of individual subjectivity and how that relates to a greater discipline, which is made of a lot of people's subjectivity and greater than the individual, and that's where the objectivity, the illusory objectivity resides. And so, and that's really what people talk about following the illusion. I don't think anyone would ever think, oh, I know it all, I'm omniscient, and hide behind that. I think that there's something, I'd be interested in someone expanding on that, about subjectivity contained within a discipline of knowledge, which is based on a collective, a collection of people.
Just there wouldn't be any psychoanalytic epistemology with that.
Yeah.
You know, that you couldn't create any knowledge of.
Yeah. So I think it's more helpful that it's just a given and that we accept that, and I, and this is kind of interesting but slightly empty, but I don't know if that's just my perception of it.
Well, no, I think we should keep that on the table and see if it is.
Wait, so you're saying that this feels slightly empty because he's trying to say that he's doing something that we really can't effectively do all the way.
That, and also he's talking about things that were done anyway, but he's then changing the perspective and sort of bringing, you know, we need to acknowledge subjectivity, which is kind of, if you think about it, becomes a bit absurd, because...
I don't think he's just saying acknowledge it, though. I think he is putting it into a more practical sense, you know.
But then I just mean, like, when you follow... When you follow through, you know, where does it get you? What does it change? And I just, what I'm interested in is the interaction between that and the individual subjectivity in a wider discipline, really, which I think is really useful to think of in these contexts, because you're not operating just as an individual, you're operating as part of a body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a really helpful background, because it can become very disorientating. How can I ever know? I'm just completely subjective. And that's the whole point of people studying the same thing, because they try and get certain essential things. They try and, like, boil it down as much as they can. This is how we get around subjectivity. We try and, like, collaborate and forge schools of thought. You know?
Well, sure. And so, and Rennick wouldn't have any trouble with the, you know, the fact that that over the decades, hundreds of obsessional patients have been seen who have, you know, certain predictable dynamics that come to play, you know, whatever kind of analyst they have, that these dynamics are being reported. He would want to build on that, you know, but he, at the same time, I don't think would... he would want to build it up in the analysis from the ground up. If it showed up, he might use what he'd learned, but I don't think he would rush to push that in a formulaic way anyway. His idea about, you know, if everything, if technique, good and bad, is infused with the analyst's subjective subjectivity, then how do you decide what's good and bad, what's good or bad technique? What he's saying is it used to be that we would think the technique that fails to catch your countertransference before it moves into an enactment would be bad technique. But he's saying basically enactment, micro, macro, is inevitable, always caught in retrospect. So how do you know good technique? And you remember his answer for that?
Is this the point where we talked about a younger versus a more experienced analyst?
No.
Oh, okay.
Basically, his thought is that the better technique is being less defensive about your own subjectivity, such that you can follow its play between you and the patient.
But that is also the point that he makes for younger and older
animals. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. I apologize. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's really taking account of the subjectivity.
See, that's my subjectivity interfering with my hearing what you said. I preferred the way he put it, which I think was more seasoned. So I'll have to work on opening up my subjectivity to your subjectivity. So that's number one. Throw out the idea that so-called countertransference enactment is to be avoided. It's impossible to avoid. It's ubiquitous.
He still wants us to reduce it or to keep it as minimized as possible, though.
I think he's even saying, the main point is don't even try.
If you
try, that makes you worse.
Well, I think he's saying that if you...
I find that really difficult, though.
I think he's saying that if you get on this train, that you will begin to see enactment in these microscopic ways that you couldn't before. I think that's really what he's saying. Yes, he's all in favor of it, of its outcome being the way he describes in his vignette here.
Later on he says that it's not just unavoidable, but it's necessary to the analytic process.
Yeah. That's just most radical. That's the third one, I think. The second one is unconscious personal motivations expressed in action by the... That one.
Yeah.
So basically the leaving product. Yeah.
See, this is exactly why I can't follow. You know, if you don't try to avoid it, how would you be able then to see its impact? How would you be able to sort of measure how far you actually went and then elicited something if you don't carefully try to keep it as minimized as possible?
What he's saying is,
you know, how could you make meaning of it then anymore?
What he's saying is this, that that it is inevitable, even at your best, of trying to be aware of yourself, that some gratification and some frustration of the patient will be present in your technique. And that he thinks that that's not regrettable, but actually necessary to it, to the process moving forward.
But how does that follow that you don't then just maintain trying to minimize it? It's great, so this part of it gets in there, that we accept that, so, and it's helpful. Why should that change your kind of approach to how much you monitor that? So, does that make sense?
Well, I think his argument would be it might actually make it easier for you to catch in retrospect if you're not having to be so defensive about it.
But he says when he describes the vignette, he realizes, you know, his own countertransference and this elicitation of the patient for the savior and all of this, because he is trying to avoid showing it, and he starts feeling heavy and, I don't know, whatever his body reaction is. But if he wouldn't be trying to avoid it, he maybe wouldn't have felt this bodily expression, feeling dense and heavy, etc.
Right.
So how then would he have been able to say, hey, this is happening to me and I don't normally feel this way, so maybe...
Well, but look, that was based on a particular object, set of object, of his own personal object relations, right? Remember his relation to his mother?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, no one has the perfect parents. You know, no one has the perfect childhood. There will be some chords of some kind that would play on, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, at that time, he's trying to do what any analyst would try to do, not show this.
Right. And his point in that is that that, you know, that would be considered ideal technique in classical analysis. Not, you know, recognizing it, trying not to show it. And the idea is, if you try to have that kind of ideal technique, it will have the least impact on the process that ensues, right? But he's saying it was already influencing his technique in negative ways. And here he was trying to do what, you know, was classically regarded as good technique. That, you know, that's really the point of that vignette.
He's saying only when I could acknowledge this, then I started to be able to
relax and think.
I think you were absolutely right with what you said at the beginning, that in order to do that, you have to try to minimize it.
Yeah, that's
great. But you'll never eradicate it. I mean, you're always trying to minimize it no matter what, from the classical perspective or his. But it's just the orientation you take to it, just the attitude alone, which opens you up.
Well, look, I think everyone, if we went around the room, everyone would have it, would set that balance differently, right? I mean,
sure.
Right? Whether you let your patient take the magazine in the waiting room home or not, whether you say good morning when the patient walks in, you know, whether you say good morning with a smile when the patient walks in, you know, whether you replace the Kleenex, you know, all of those kinds of things that we might think of as nurturing, gratifying. Some of us would do less of that. Some of us would be more austere in the way we make comments. Some of us might use more folksy language. So that, I think the point would be that those frustrations and gratifications are going to be there in every analyst in some mix or other. And well, I'm kind of beating a dead horse. I know it. So I won't say it again.
I think the minimization point. Is that an answer for you now?
Well, for myself, it is. I'm not showing what he's sort of advocating, you know.
Well, I do feel that. I mean, he's saying that in this passage in the vignette, that if he had not tried to minimize it, what was 556, 557, where he talks about his mother and feeling like he should save the patient, and in that sense, if he had gone with it straight away and let the patient elaborate on that precise thought, then that would have had the same outcome, I feel. It wasn't necessary for him to inhibit first. I don't think that was necessary, but it was. That was the problem, and that's what I think he's advocating. So he's not. He's actually going against this minimization. I do think he's. Mm-hmm. He doesn't advocate minimization. For me. Mm-hmm. Do you not see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because that was not a necessary part of the process.
I think the good point about this vignette is that he's saying, I realize that even if I'm trying to hold back, it's coming through, it's leaking.
Yeah.
And it's affecting, this leakage is affecting my interpretations and my analytic work.
Absolutely.
Negatively.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stop leaking and I'm going to see what's happening here.
I'm
going to
open the floodgate. Sort of. I mean, you know, I'm going to put it extremely.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But then the analysis is able to kind of take this course again.
And still interpret, yeah. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
I
because he's able to do his work again.
Yeah. But he's.
I'm not sure whether we're getting confused by, you know, perspective on making use of the transference or making use of the transference in Ekman.
I think what he's saying is that maybe another analyst with a more practical perspective wouldn't have seen that in his trying to constrain his counter transference, it was still leaking.
That's exactly the problem, you know, it's leaking in the transference or the transference in Ekman. think that's the crucial difference. Because you could still realize it within the transference. But then it's the question, to what extent do you allow for enactment? And he, I think he argues, or he might argue, I'm not sure if I get that right.
I think he argues that it's going to be enacted anyway.
Yeah. Like, no, or even that when it gets, the more it gets enacted, or you feel it more prominently, or you even have to feel that in order to allow for a certain process to unfold.
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I think in order to make meaning from something, I think that's the way I understand it. It's better not to try to inhibit. And
yeah, but
that's not
I'm
trying to minimize, because that will actually, it will complicate making meaning.
No, but at the same time, he's not saying, let's just, as analysts, say whatever comes to mind. Like, let's just...
I think he is advocating some spontaneity, though. I mean, I think he's not, I think he is quite radical. I mean, I agree with you that he's not just saying, oh, it could, you know, you could just go ahead and have a normal conversation.
Well, let's look at the opposite, then. Suppose he said, in hearing about this patient's marriage, so why don't you leave him? You said, don't inhibit. I mean, that would have been the direction, right?
Yeah.
Rescue, you know. So what's the problem here? You're not leaving. What's holding you back, right? Well, I'm really not being funny about it. I mean, I guess I am being funny about it. I mean, but my point is that as long as you were open to the impact of that on the patient and following that out, I think he's suggesting that could be as potentially useful as inhibiting it. I think he is saying both are problematic, but the real problematic part is you're imagining you're not having this impact on your own technique and on the patient, and that so that if you over inhibit or you under inhibit, it could potentially have negative impact. You will minimize the negative impact if you can be open to that and follow it out into what happens. For example, what if the patient says in response to that, well, who do you think you are giving me advice about my marriage, Dr. Rennick? You know, I've been with this guy, you know. Well, don't you then begin to see how things come a little more in perspective? The analyst would, I hope, rather quickly realize he's overreached and would begin to wonder, well, now, how did I get into that? You see, so even if you did the opposite and did an enactment in the other direction, it might then lead you to try to say, well, how did that come about? Well, how did I get drawn into this? So on and so forth.
And how much of that could be transparent to the patient? To what extent could or should that process be transparent, do you think, in his model? Because, he's talking to other analysts here, right? We need to do more self-reflection and situating ourselves and understanding our own subjectivity, but...
Well, Owen Rennick would have it more transparent than most. That's what that's really what the subject of that article, Playing Your Cards Face Up, is about. The technical implications of his work are he's willing to, if he holds a strong opinion about something, he's willing to express it to the patient directly, with the idea that something good might come of that in the interchange between the analyst and the patient, if the analyst can be open to the impact of speaking his opinion so directly as having on the patient. we don't have time to read his other papers. You know, obviously the point of all 12, 13 of these papers, 14 of these papers, is to whet your appetites and pursue any of them more deeply than we have been able to.
Are there responses to his papers?
Oh, voluminous.
Okay.
You could do a whole course on a cluster of four of his papers. Reading his papers and all the responses to them, whole course. No question about it. Last one, and then I want to tell you some about the Hoffman for next week. The third implication is, since the analyst is acting on his own personal motivations and that those are inherent in productive technique, where does analytic work leave off and exploitation of the analytic situation by the analyst begin? See, I think to put this on the table in the way he is and to come to this question tells you the kind of mind. You know, he doesn't wait for somebody else to say this to him. He brings this to the table. And he basically says, doesn't it make more sense to agree that what holds us back from exploiting the patient are the ethical norms that our community sets up than some kind of illusory theory that says, you know, if you act out with the patient's fantasies won't get analyzed?
I wonder if that's the case for everybody.
That ethical norms hold...
Yeah.
Well, of course not. I mean...
No, I'm not saying that they violate them, but maybe some other people, for them, the technical sort of rules make more sense rather than the ethical ones. Or they don't replace them, or they're not guided or are backed by only the ethical rules. If we don't, you know, if we maybe... we sort of leave aside those radical cases as in having intercourse with your patients, for example, but just if it comes to like minor sort of enactments.
You mean maybe the classical rules protect certain analysts from doing that more often than they do?
No, they protect them from enactment in general. The meaning that there should be to the technical rules rather than the ethical ones.
Well, I think Rennick would say it doesn't protect them from enactment. It encourages a different kind of enactment.
Yeah, okay, that's a different perspective.
Yeah.
But why are you more sympathetic to that than to Mitchell's sort of, well, there's room for negotiation sometimes, right, for gratification sometimes. Because isn't he saying the same thing, essentially? That we already are gratifying. The principle of absence is obviously flawed, does not provide an effective case. Why are you saying? Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, in a way, I would say that you need this paper to get to Mitchell's idea about negotiation with the patient. I mean, you can hear Rennick taking that up, right? You can hear his saying to say you must get on the couch and you must do it three times, you know, four times a week, etc., etc. You can hear Rennick backing Mitchell in that regard, but I think he would also acknowledge that many people find that more frequent meetings, not for everyone, but I think Rennick would be happy to acknowledge, you know, like Joe was saying, what the group at large has found. I mean, he would say frequent meetings, you know, intensification of the treatment, maximum regression, getting more access to your own mind, etc., etc. So, two things about next week. Three things. Three things about next week. One is Erwin Hoffman's paper on dialectical thinking and the psychoanalytic process. And you know, we started with the idea of therapeutic action, and we're returning to the idea of therapeutic action. And here we're going to be focused on a dialectic between adhering to psychoanalytic rituals and more self-expressive forms of relating with the patient. And, you know, you can see there's a kind of continuum from Mitchell to Rennick to this paper. And really what he's going to use that dialectic to raise the question about therapeutic action and what's therapeutic. So that's one thing. The second thing is to acknowledge that next week will be your last class with me. After next week, you'll be meeting for six times with Dr. Long on topics that you have cooked up with her. And I wanted to know if you would like to share some food next week as a kind of celebratory, compensatory. I'm not defensive, I can handle it. Marker of the end of our 12 weeks together.
Should we bring some stuff then?
Maybe we could all, you know, because if one person tries, I mean, I'm happy to do it, but if one person tries to get around food allergies and kosher laws and et cetera, it would be impossible. But why don't we, are any of the guys in here good cooks? Good, okay. So all of the guys can bring drinks.
What's good cook here?
We didn't get the time.
He's a good cook. He's a good cook.
That's
a new excuse.
And all of the girls. This side of the table bring drinks, and this side of the table bring food, and I'll bring some food.
Okay. What kind of drinks? Alcoholic?
Yeah, that was
No. I won't. Well, I mean, you can bring it for yourselves, but I won't drink it. I won't be able to. I won't be able to think after a full day of practice and having a glass
do you
of
like
wine.
Soft drinks?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Water's fine too for me. So, anything not to bring? Does anybody have a peanut allergy or anything like that that you'll admit? Okay, good. So we'll all bring some food and share some food and drinks together as we talk about Hoffman's paper next week. There's a senior event. You're welcome to use those, but you never know how many they are.
Eat this paper.
I'll bring some of those.